Blog Talk Radio.
Now listening live to the Divine Prince, Pan-African spiritualist, practitioner, author, and advisor, Elogun Oloye Hudu Obeya Bokua. Call me the stone that the builder refused. sharing with you in all things spiritual, mystical, metaphysical, cosmic, universal, evolutionary, revolutionary, healing, and holistic from a Pan-African hoodoo world spiritualist perspective. Understanding that all is truly and indeed a blessing. If you can just see beyond the veil, for it is all just an illusion and a test and one of the greatest divine mysteries of this life cycle. This is my constant prayer, my mantra, affirmation, reverberation, reiteration, and it is my ever-living reality. All is a blessing. It's crucial to the very foundation of my inner standing, my teaching, my walk, my work along this divine, all-blessed life path and journey. It is how I, the Divine Prince, make sense out of all that we are challenged with here in our daily existence on Mother, Father, Earth. And it is my personal place of power and understanding, place from where I begin, the place from where I realize and crystallize all my endeavors, understanding that I and I alone create and co-create my divine destiny. And I alone create and co-create my divine, all-blessed reality. And so it is. Ashe. Greetings and salutations, one and all, individually and collectively. It is May 17th, Friday, May 17th, 2024, and I am emanating and vibrating with you and for you now live. Virtually, verbally, cosmically, quantum universally, from this working temple of the House of the Divine Prince, Hoodoo Central LLC, in this legendary, beautiful, historic, and most enchanted city in America, New Orleans, Louisiana, the land of my ancestors and my grandparents and those who came before me along this spiritual hoodoo over their life and journey. Passing down the great Obia stick, along with the knowledge of the life-giving herbs, roots, plants, rituals, spirits, and minerals. I'm always honored and grateful to be in your divine, all-blessed presence to share this sacred space with you at high noon, U.S. Central Standard Time, each and every working weekday that I am available on multi-platforms. Certainly blogtalkradio.com/the-divine-prince and all social media platforms that StreamYard reaches into to share the legacy, the culture and tradition, the history of our sacred story. In the past few podcasts, we've been talking about how magic conjure root working, voodoo with four O's, voodoo with the U, have always been utilized from day one in our, you know, our unfortunate genocide into the Middle Passage and then our survival here in the so-called New World and ultimately within the Pan-African community globally. We find the footprint of those great mothers and fathers, great aunties and uncles, great practitioners who came before us, who we now give thanks and reverence to that dwell in the spirit realm, but also walk among us. We understand that the Black woman is God. Indeed, the Black woman is God. The Black woman is God. We hear about the bearded Arabic God and the bearded Hebrew God, and we very rarely hear about the Divine Mother, certainly supported by archaeology, biology, DNA, that all humanity birthed from the womb, the cradle of Mother Africa. So indeed, the Black woman is God, and the ancestors who are our front line of defense stand up in our DNA archaeology, biology, chemistry has now demonstrated from memory survive in the blood. So you are uniquely triggered when you see certain injustices, when you feel certain injustices in society, when you experience certain personal injustices within your own life path and experience. There is a certain familiarity that's not so much associated with our personal experience, but also is associated with ancestral memory. There's nothing like a horror story to concentrate and focus our deepest fears and inhibitions and fragility in America, and certainly as African American studies scholar Michelle Y. Gordon has written. That's just what white newspapers in Louisiana did during the Reconstruction. And we've been discussing the Reconstruction over the last few days, the Civil War over the last few days, certainly the Bois Caymon and the subsequent Haitian Revolution and their effects on not only bringing voodoo out into the open in the American, you know, vernacular, but also creating a greater sense of defense and objection and objectification, bastardization toward not just voodoo, but indeed Aboriginal, indigenous spirituality and traditions that would upset the balance of slavery and the slave economy at the time. The Haitian Revolution certainly put the fear of God in the oppressors and the plantation owners, whose greatest nightmare, greatest horror story was our ability to drum, dance, sing, chant down the gods and awaken the ancestors and develop some sense of invulnerability. Certainly an invulnerability that was demonstrated in more than one way in Bois Caymon, but certainly many Maroon uprisings, many escaping enslaved ancestors utilized, and we have a footprint of this utilization of root work, conjure, voodoo, hoodoo, to create this invulnerability, but certainly to expand their consciousness beyond the limits of the illusion of physicality, the illusion of the material. For indeed, the spiritual realm is more real, more evident, more affectatious than anything we can envision in our creative imaginations within our physical, material, plastic universe. Again, that's not just some voodoo new age philosophy. It is indeed supported in physics. It is indeed supported in quantum metaphysics. It is indeed supported in the macrocosm that is mirrored in the microcosm that reflects universal power, our cosmic universal reach. So Michelle Y. Gordon wrote that within the white newspapers in Louisiana during Reconstruction, turning white supremacist worries about black freedom into unsettling tales of voodoo. In subsequent shows, I'm going to also talk about some literary entitlement, you know, that were taken, creative entitlement and some literary work. I mean, certainly how it began to show up in pop cultural media forms of that time and certainly into the present day to subvert the power of ATR, traditional African-based religious system, subvert the power of Pan-African spiritual tradition, subvert the power of Aboriginal indigenous spiritual practice. And generally speaking, for the very same reasons as always, power, greed, control. Gordon notes that New Orleans did have real practitioners of voodoo, a synthesis of African religions and Roman Catholicism, closely linked to Haitian voodoo. Through the 19th century, black women often led its worship and magical practices. But we've demonstrated in this platform that there was certainly a foundation of men who operated perhaps more secretly, for the retribution could have been much harsher in many cases. Supposed eyewitness and secondhand accounts of voodoo ceremonies and white papers had little to do with the authentic practice of the tradition. Newspapers promised stories of voodoos on the rampage and full particulars of the hell, broth, and orgies. An 1870s account in New Orleans Daily Picayune described a female voodoo leader demanding that her followers sacrifice animals, destroy crops, participate in sexual orgies, and ultimately participate in a Lord's Supper consisting of her own infant. But we know that this was not true. Voodoo stories increasingly highlighted the presence of upper-class white women at these ceremonies, in line with the techniques used by classic horror writers, such as noted 1920s racist H.P. Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft, white journalists often referenced unnameable evil. The New York Evening Post, for example, insisted that printed accounts were tame compared to their horrible midnight orgy, which the white man is not allowed to witness. Gordon notes that the stories often made their political implications explicit. For example, one 1869 Daily Picayune item warned of the measureless influence that voodoo priests will exercise on our executive and legislative authority with the election of black leaders. In the 1870s and 1880s, as white supremacist arguments became more focused on the defense of white women, voodoo stories increasingly highlighted the presence of upper-class white women at these ceremonies. And in an 1895 book, journalist Judge Henry Castellanos recalled an antebellum raid on a ritual. He said blacks and whites were circling around promiscuously, writhing and muscular contractions, panting, raving, and frothing at the mouth. But the most degrading and infamous feature of this scene was the presence of a very large number of ladies moving in the highest walks of society, and certainly he meant white women. In Castellanos' account, the arrest of one of these women prompted her husband to commit suicide the next day. In contrast, Gordon notes many of the stories reference participation by white male laborers with no particular concern. And we know that at the root of many of the lynchings that would follow, certainly the abuse, the offense to, you know, of a white woman was the easiest excuse, the easiest charge to level against a black human being. And in the 1890s, Louisiana's white supremacists rolled back much of the progress of Reconstruction. Lynchings peaked in 1896, and black citizens were almost completely disenfranchised. As that happened, Gordon writes, accounts of voodoo worship virtually disappeared from the local white papers. The stories reappeared in the Jim Crow era as historical accounts of evils of Reconstruction. Of course, black journalists had never bought the white account of voodoo. Through the Reconstruction years, black papers across the country warned their readers that the weird and ghastly inventions of the white press were intended to bolster white supremacy. For my part, one 1889 article calls, for my part, New York Age editorial concludes, "I only wish that there was such a power as voodooism known to the Negroes of the South or elsewhere, that they might practice a little of it on their white adversaries." And we see that same sentiment showing up in more modern times among Black nationalists, among some so-called, you know, conscious folk who are rightly so questioning, you know, not only Black politics and our involvement in, you know, American politics, but religion, certainly, and spiritual practices such as voodoo, hoodoo, Yoruba practice, and the like. And I ask, in a more modern context, a same question. To what degree, for what purpose, are we utilizing this so-called magic that many profess to believe in, many profess to operate today in our social media spaces, in our pop cultural spaces? To what degree are we using it for liberation, for binding that which is truly wicked within our community, within our reality? Greetings, Alexis Williams. Thank you for coming. Craig Burns, greetings and salutations. Sean Jean Nguyen, we certainly appreciate you and yours for being here with me today. Always honored and grateful for my live chatters. And I'm also certainly grateful for my international audience who listens and participates by way of area code 563-999-3763. And certainly by visiting my Blog Talk Radio website page at blogtalkradio.com/the-divine-prince. And I invite you all to visit my YouTube, my main account at YouTube, and certainly like, share, subscribe, and you can now join and support me by joining the page by way of YouTube. I'm certainly thankful, grateful, and appreciative of all of your love and your support. We know, as I was beginning to mention earlier, that there were books that were written that disparaged voodoo. Certainly from pulpits, both Black and white, there was a reasoning behind their need to demonize voodoo and bastardize and create voodoo as an abominable practice within the so-called slave mentality. But there was active political, governmental, institutional, organized activity to disenfranchise our sense of belief, certainly self-belief, belief in ourselves, but belief in all those things that would have been encoded within the very DNA of our blood as it relates to our connection to nature. Voodoo can be used as witchcraft. Islam can be used as witchcraft. Judaism and the Kabbalah can be used as witchcraft. Certainly Christianity can be used as and is used as witchcraft. But voodoo at its root, its foundation, is nature. Voodoo is nature. Voodoo is nature. Ifa is nature. Santeria, Palo, Lukumi, Kendable is nature. And so certainly there would be no voodoo without the plant, the herbs, the root, the vegetation, the organic matter and material, the mineral compositions that make up our very lives, our very physical reality. And so there is a thin veil between our creative imagination and spirit. There's a thin veil between one dimensional space and the next. Research string theory in your free time. But certainly the witchcraft has been well documented at the governmental level, the institutional level, in both secular and religious spaces, even in modern days, as we discussed in you know, previous shows in the last week or so, 2 weeks or so. And one of the first is certainly the trial that gave voodoo its worst name happened in 1864. That case ended with the execution of 8 Haitians for child murder and cannibalism, and has and continues to define the notions and religion of what voodoo is until this present day. An engraving probably made from a contemporary artist sketch shows the 8 Haitian voodoo devotees found guilty in February 1864. And many of us within this shared space, this sacred space, I like to say the most erudite audience on the internet, is familiar with the black and white engraving of 8 white clad voodoo devotees with 5 Haitian soldiers. I'm sorry, yeah, Haitian soldiers or military soldiers standing behind them. The Haitian 8 voodoo devotees found guilty in February 1864 of the murder and cannibalism of a 12-year-old child, and this is quoting from Harper's Weekly. It was a Saturday market day in Port-au-Prince. So these were Haitian, I'll say Haitian colonial military police. It was a Saturday market day in Port-au-Prince, and the chance to meet friends, gossip, and shop had drawn large crowds to the Haitian capital. Sophisticated, French-educated members of the urban ruling class crammed into the market square beside illiterate farmers and a generation removed from slavery who had walked in from the surrounding villages for a rare day out. And understand there were surrounding villages, but there were also neighboring Maroon camps in many locations south of the border, certainly from the Caribbean to South America. But this was no less of importance in Haiti as it may have been in Brazil. So the whole of the country had assembled, and it was for this reason that Fabre Geoffroy had chosen February 13, 1864 as a date for 8 high-profile executions. Haiti's reformist president wished to make an example of these 4 men and 4 women because they had been found guilty of a hideous crime, abducting, murdering, and cannibalizing a 12-year-old girl, and also because they represented everything Geoffroy hoped to leave behind him as he molded his country into a quote-unquote modern nation. The backwardness of the hinterlands, its African past, and above all, its so-called folk religion. President Fabre Geoffroy, whose efforts to reform Haiti ended in disappointment when he was accused of corruption and forced to flee the country by a violent coup. Call that religion what you will, voodoo with A, U's, and X's, voodoo with A-N-D-A-U-X, voodoo with V-O-D-O-U, call it what you will, spell it how you will, Haiti's history had long been intertwined with it. It had arrived in slave ships centuries earlier, flourished in the backwoods of Maroon campments and villages and plantations that Christian priests had never visited. In 1791, it was generally believed a secret voodoo ceremony, Bois Caimon, had provided the spark for the violent uprising that liberated the country from its French masters. The single example of a successful slave rebellion in the history of the world. Outside Haiti, though, voodoo was perceived as primitive, animal-like in nature, paganistic, if you will, And it was nothing but West African superstition, serpent worship, wrote the British traveler Hesketh Pritchard, who walked across the Haitian interior in 1899, and believers indulged in their rites and their orgies with practical impunity, he quoted. For visiting Westerners of this sort, voodoo's popularity in itself was proof that the Black Republic of Haiti could not claim to be civilized. It was hard to conceive of a case more likely to bring voodoo and Haiti into greater disrepute than the murder that was being punished that Saturday in 1854. The killing had taken place in the village of Bizotan, just outside the gates of Port-au-Prince, and at least according to the newspaper stories that fizz over the world telegraph wires that spring, it was the work of a Westerner by the name of Congo Pele, who had sacrificed his own niece in the hope of winning favor from the voodoo god. Little is known for certain of the Affair de Bizotan. No trial transcript survived, and the truth, as Kate Ramsey observed in her own study of voodoo and Haitian law, was long ago lost in a miasma of prejudice and misreporting. The most detailed account of the murder came from the pen of Sir Spencer St. John, who was the British charge d'affaires in Port-au-Prince. St. John's account helped define Haiti as a place where ritual murder and cannibalism were commonplace and usually went unpunished according to their belief. The charge proved so influential that as recently as 2010, the magnitude 7.0 earthquake that leveled much of the capital could still be blamed on supposed pact with the devil that the country had signed by turning to voodoo. St. Spencer St. John, British Charge d'Affaires in Haiti during the 1860s, compiled by far the most dastardly account of the Bizotan affair, and he believed implicitly in the reality of child sacrifice by voodoo worshipers and practitioners. And we know this not to be true. For St. John, who said he had made the most careful inquiries into the murder, the affair seemed straightforward and hideous. Pele, the diplomat reported, had been a laborer, a gentleman's servant, an idler, who had grown resentful at his poverty and was anxious to improve his position without exertion on his part. And since he was the brother of a noted voodoo priestess, the solution appeared obvious. The gods and spirits could provide for him. Sometime in December 1863, Jean Pele agreed to help his brother. It was settled between them, St. John's wrote, that about the new year, some sacrifice should be offered to propitiate the serpent. So they claim this was done to honor Dambala, if indeed we're talking about Aiedewedo, the serpent. The only difficulty was the scale of Congo's ambition. While a more modest man would have been satisfied with a white cock or a white goat, on this solemn occasion, it was thought better to offer a more important sacrifice. Two voodoo priests were consulted, and it was they who recommended that the Peles offer up the goat without horns, that is, a human sacrifice. Jean Pele did not have to look far for a suitable victim, it was said. She told her sister's child, a girl named Claire Sin, who St. John says was 12 years old at the time, on December 27, 1863. Jean, the sister, invited her sister to visit Port-au-Prince with her and in their absence, Congo Pele and the two priests seized Claire Steen. They bound and gagged her and hid her beneath the altar of a nearby temple. The girl stayed there 4 full days and nights. Finally, after dark on New Year's Eve, an elaborate voodoo ceremony was held. As its climax, St. John says, Claire Steen was strangled, flayed, decapitated, and dismembered. Her body was cooked, and her blood caught and kept in a jar. Writing a quarter of a century later, the diplomat spared his readers none of the unpleasant details of the bloody feast that followed. Perhaps he calculated that they would not wish to be. He also set out the evidence that had been assembled against the Peles and their associates together with details of other cases that proved, he thought, that the murder was not an isolated incident. Voodoo paraphernalia throughout the misappropriation of voodoo, the bastardization of voodoo symbology, including, you know, the said voodoo doll, which is not authentic to either West African practice, Haitian practice, has become sort of embodied into hoodoo practice, but really doesn't have a authentic root to the creation of Papet, other voodoo paraphernalia. But before asking whether Claire Steen really was sacrificed to African gods, let alone whether cannibalism was a normal part of voodoo, it may help to know a little more about the place that the religion held in Haiti. Voodoo was, to begin with, the face of most Haitians. As late as 1860, the country was only nominally Christian. The urban elite may have been more or less Catholic, but the masses of people in the countryside were not. Bible teachings possessed awkward questions in a slaveholding society. Thus, while the old French colonies hated Negro code, had made it compulsory to baptize new slaves within 8 days of their arrival, most plantation owners made no real attempt to Christianize them, nor was it easy for any religion to take root in the brutal conditions in which most blacks worked. And we know this was a similar story here in the Deep South. The climate, back-breaking labor, and fever killed 10% of Haiti's 500,000-strong population every year and severely curtailed fertility. This meant, as Laurent Dubois notes, that fully 2/3 of the slaves in Haiti on the eve of the revolt of 1791 had been born in Africa. 2/3. They brought with them their ancient religion. Scholars of voodoo believe that its Catholic trappings were implanted, not in Haiti, but in the coastal regions of the Congo, where local rulers converted to Christianity as early as the 15th century. Matters scarcely improved after independence. Most Haitian rulers professed Christianity. They believed it imported the identity with the free nations of the West. But they also insisted on a Haitian clergy, not to mention the right to appoint bishops, that the Catholic Church would not concede, with the result that in 1804, a schism occurred between Haiti and Rome. And since there was no more than 3 churches still standing, and the rubble of the revolution, and 6 priests in the entire country, little progress was made in converting the people of the interior in the years before this breach was healed with a concordance signed in 1860. The handful of clergy who did serve in Haiti during these years were mostly renegades, Dubois writes, debauched opportunists who got rich selling sacraments to gullible Haitians. Voodoo thrived in these conditions, and it was hardly surprising that when Geoffroy's immediate predecessor, Faustin Salucque, was nominated as president in 1847, Haiti found itself ruled by a former slave who was an open adherent of the African religion. Faustin Salucque, better known as Emperor Faustin I, 1849 to 1859, was the first Haitian leader to openly support voodoo. A former enslaved African, he derived mystical prestige from his association with the religion. So we know there's a root there for someone who came much later, who masked as Baron Samedi to support his wicked endeavors in Haiti. And knowing a little of the effects of the schism and of Salucque's dubious 12-year regime makes it easier to understand why Fabre Geoffroy, who was anxious to persecute the principles of the Affaire de Bizantin and to label Cassin's killers as voodooists. The concordat signed in March 1860 committed the president to making Catholicism Haiti's state religion, and the executions of February 1864, which so clearly demonstrated Christian orthodoxy, took place just weeks before the priest of the first mission to the country arrived from Rome. The trial was followed up, moreover, by a redrafting of Haiti's Code Penal, which increased the fines levied for sorcery sevenfold, and added that all dances and other practices that maintain the spirit of fetishism and superstition in the populace will be considered spells and punished with the same penalties. Under Geoffroy's attempts, other activities were made to curb our customs, like to upset the Pope. The public nudity was still common in the interior, and a 99% illegitimacy rate that was accompanied, Dubois says, by bigamy, trigamy, all the way to septigamy, according to Dubois. And certainly all these things were likely to continue to upset the Pope. We've talked in previous shows about the Pope sort of creating an edict, if you will, for the Latinx community, particularly Cuba, allowing them to convert to Catholicism, maintain their, you know, connection to their so-called African superstitions on their downtime. And so this relationship, this dancing act between our spiritual practices and the Catholic Church is not new, and certainly the great body of Haitians, I believe some 40% of this elite populace that fled to Louisiana, certainly brought this code noir, this black code system with them, and helped to increase in a location that was governed primarily by Creoles at the time, and helped to sort of supplant this black code behavior here in Louisiana and further force voodoo, certainly with 4-0, or voodoo with the U, into underground practice. It was only through entertainment and performance by way of Marie Laveau, some would say, by way of hoodoo blues, others would say, that the practice began to sort of reemerge again in a more public face in pop culture. Geoffroy was equally anxious to distance himself from Salucque, who in 1849 had made the country something of a laughingstock by crowning himself Emperor Faustin I. He was not the first Haitian emperor. That honor belongs to Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who had ruled as Jacques. And although Murdo MacLeod argues that he was a shrewder ruler than most historians allow, he is usually portrayed as a buffoon, lazy and poorly educated. Soloquay, it was widely believed, had been handpicked by Haiti's Senate as the most malleable possible candidate for the presidency. Unable to obtain a golden crown, he had been elevated to the throne wearing one made of cardboard. Once in power, however, the new emperor derived, MacLeod says, significant mystical prestige from his association with voodoo. Either one would have frightened the heck out of Louisiana and subsequently America. Indeed, it was widely thought he was enthralled to it, and St. John noted that during the reign of Soloquay, a priestess was arrested for having promoted a sacrifice too openly. When about to be conducted to prison, a foreign bystander remarked aloud that probably she would be shot. She laughed and said, "If I were to beat the sacred drum and march through the city, not one from emperors downward, but would humbly follow me." So indeed, there are roots and fear to any Aboriginal indigenous practices, but particularly voodoo, hoodoo, and its relationship to the Black populace, both enslaved and now free, who are beginning to sort of wake up, if you will, to the practice, to the tradition, and the sequence of the mysteries embedded within the practices and the tradition. What all this means, I think, is that voodoo became a fault line running through the very heart of Haitian society after 1804. For most citizens, and especially for the rural blacks who had borne the brunt of both slavery and the struggle for independence, it became a potent symbol of our dignities and new freedom, a religion that, as Du Bois notes, helped carve out a place where the enslaved could temporarily escape the order that saw them only as chattel property during colonial times, and went on to create communities of trust that stretched between the different plantations and into the town. And for the local elite, who tended to be a mixed race and were often French educated, though, voodoo was holding Haiti back. It was alien and frightening to those who did not understand it. It was associated with slave rebellion. And after Soloquay's rise, it was of the most brutal and backward of the country's rulers. These considerations combined to help make Haiti a pariah state throughout the 19th century, and some would say until today. Dessalines and his successor, Henri Christophe, who had every reason to fear the United States, France, Britain, and Spain, would overthrow their revolution and re-enslave the population, given the chance, tried to isolate the country. But even after economic necessity forced them to reopen the trade in sugar and coffee, the self-governing Black Republic of Haiti remained a dangerous abomination in the eyes of every white state involved in the slave trade. Like Soviet Russia in the 1920s, feared to be almost literally infectious, liable to inflame other Blacks with the desire for liberty. Giffard was not the only Haitian leader to look for ways to prove that his was a nation much like the other great powers. Christian, white supremacist, governed by the rule of law. And with all that bore in mind, let us return to the Haiti of 1864 and the Affaire de Bizantin. There is no need to assume that Spencer St. John was a wholly unreliable observer. His account of the legal proceedings that took place that year chimes well with the contemporary press coverage. There are a few discrepancies. Francine is stated in newspaper sources to have not 12, but the journalist's accounts are, for the most part, more purple and more partial than the diplomat. What's most interesting about St. John's account is his admission that the trial was open to criticism. His chief concern was the use of force to beat confessions out of the subject. All the prisoners, the diplomat observed, had at first refused to speak, thinking that the voodoo would protect them, and it required the frequent application of the club to drive this belief out of their head. Later, hauled up before the judge, the prisoners were bullied, cajoled, cross-questioned in order to avowal, in fact, to make them state in open court what they said to have confessed in their preliminary examination. And we saw this same demonstration in the Salem witch trials and the many other, the Christian, the Spanish Inquisition, like persecution of women, the enslaved, so-called witches, heretics, and some might even say modern-day police and patywolves. We saw similar, if not the same, tactics being used to coerce guilty when the parties are not guilty, to folks to admit to murders and crimes that we now know they did not commit. The God's Initiative, I don't know what happened to my sound. Did my sound come back? Please forgive me, chat. I didn't see God's Initiative. I didn't see your question until almost 30 minutes later. I hope I have not been talking for 30 minutes unheard in YouTube. I still have 9 people in the chat, so I'm going to assume that I'm being heard somewhere, maybe just not in YouTube. But I certainly appreciate your listenership and your participation. I wish you had sent me a private text, beloved, so that I could attend. Oh, wow, I've been unmuted. I've been muted since the beginning of the show. Blog Talk Radio. You can hear me in Blog Talk Radio. They cannot hear me in YouTube and my StreamYard because I've been muted through the whole show. Please forgive me, y'all. Y'all know I got a lot on my plate. Please forgive me, y'all. I'm typing into the chat now so they know what happened. Okay. I know I didn't spell that right, but y'all get the message. I've been muted in YouTube, Facebook, probably my own EarthCam page since the beginnings of the show. I do apologize. I would love to say it was a technical difficulty, but I've been muted in YouTube since the beginning of the show. If you are seriously considering listening to the show and it was all captured in Blog Talk Radio, I implore you to visit me in blogtalkradio.com/the-divine-print. I assure you it was worth your time. YouTube, I will re-upload the audio for my paid subscribers only in YouTube. For my new paid subscribers only, I will re-upload the entire show. It was great. It was an excellent podcast. We certainly heard it and enjoyed it in Blog Talk Radio. I apologize. You all have been muted in YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, probably my own EarthCam page. You all have been muted since the very beginning. So I'm going to upload it so that you can hear the audio in its entirety to YouTube. I invite you to come back, join me in my YouTube paid subscribers only, and enjoy the podcast from today. Until tomorrow, I'm offering you peace and love, clarity and understanding when it comes to your technology, clarity and understanding in your life. Until next time, I certainly appreciate each and every one of you who sat through the silence anyway. I'm grateful for my ever-present international listening Blog Talk Radio audience, my original podcasting platform, Blog Talk Radio. I can always be listened to as well as visited 563-999-3643 during live airing podcasts only. You can go and visit an archive. Also, there is a live chat in Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/the-divine-print. Nothing beats a failure but a trial. We go come at it again on Monday. All is a blessing. I certainly am grateful for you. Thank you for sticking in there, Craig Burns. Thank you, Alexis Williams. I do apologize. I know some of my regular listeners have Blog Talk Radio on backup. I have to sign into both platforms every day in order to, you know, reach all the audience that we certainly reach. I appreciate your participation, the God's Initiative, because had you have fit in chat, I would not have known. So I'm grateful, thankful for you always coming through for me. I certainly appreciate you. And I'll see you all on Monday at noon. All is a blessing, peace and love, joy and prosperity. Ashe, Asheo, and Ashe.
Congo Square. The almost Indians, the Olmos Indians prepared this place for us centuries before our arrival, a sacred spot where corn festivals were celebrated. The Olmos Indians prepared this place for us centuries before our arrival. Congo Square, a sacred spot where corn festivals were celebrated. And as the colonizers came, our host, the Olmos Indians, they pushed aside our host. The colonizers came and pushed aside our host and introduced us in chains. And by the late 1700s, we somehow, recognizing the sacredness of Les Places de Congo, we somehow, and the how of our somehow persuasive methodologies is not clear at this moment. The how is not clear. How our persuasive methodologies worked is not clear at this moment, but nevertheless, even as slaves, we crafted and created a space where we could be free to be we. And thusly, Thusly we countered the sacrilegiousness of the French, giving great homage to our ancestors as well as giving praise and thanks to our red-blooded brothers and sisters. This is an oral libation toast to Congo Square, to Native Americans, to our ancestors who made a circle out of a square and gave us a way to stay ourselves, save ourselves from the transformatory ugliness of America, which refuses to recognize the spirituality of life. Which refuses to recognize the spirituality of life and celebrates death with crosses and crosses, double and triple crosses, the middle passage, the first cross, Christianity, the double cross, and capitalism, the ultimate triple coup de grace cross of our captivity. But the terror of crosses notwithstanding, we sang. We beat, we be, we was and is. Hail Congo Square, Congo, Congo Square. Our African gods have not been obliterated. They have merely retreated inside the beat of us, inside the beat of us. Our African gods have not been obliterated. They have merely retreated inside the beat of us until we are ready to release them into a world that we recreate, a world heralded by the beat, be, beat, being, beating, being of black heart drums, heart beat, heart beat. Heart be at this place be heart be we beating place in new world space, beating being in place in new world, preserving our ancient pace. Our dance is the God walk, our music the God talk. First thing we do, let's get together, circle ourselves into community. No beginning, no end, connected together and singing, ringing, singing in a ring. Second, let's be original, aboriginal, be what we were before we became what we are. Be Bambula dance, be Banza music, and sing song words which have no English translation. Third, let us remember. Let us remember never to forget, even when we can't remember the specifics. We must retain the essentials. Let us remember never to forget. Even when we can't remember the specifics, we must retain the essentials. The bounce, the blood flow, the feel, the spirit grow, energy. Must retain and pass on the essential usness that others want to dissipate, whip out of us.
Whoa!
But no matter, no matter how much of us they prohibit, no matter how much of us they prohibit, deep inside us is us. Deep inside us is us. Remains us inside and needs only the beat to set us free. The beat to free us. It is morning, a sun day, a field without shade, but dark with the people black of us in various shades, eclipsing the sun with our elegance. We are centuries later now, and still this sacred ground calls us to remember, to beat, to be. We are centuries later now, and still this sacred ground calls us to remember, to beat, to be. Beat Congo Square. Be Congo Square. Beat, be. Beat, be. Beat,
so.
Congo Square. Be Congo Square. Remember. Remember.